Good evening and welcome to the LSE. My name is Ricky Burdett. I'm a professor of urban studies here at the LSE and with Philip Rode, who's in the front here, run a research center called LSE Cities. Tonight, not only are we excited about hearing Jagan Shah, who I'll introduce in a moment, talk about a very important initiative happening in the urban world in India, but we're also coming to the concluding week of the second year of the Executive Masters in Cities, which is an ongoing program of with a number of international participants, very experienced figures from literally all over the world who are here this week, focusing on two major task force studies in terms of strategic planning and master plan studying. And Jagan is also part of the teaching faculty, effectively, for that project this week. The way we will run this evening is very simple. Jagan will speak for about 45 minutes or so. We'll then have about half an hour for Q&A. When we come to the Q&A, can you please, we don't need a microphone, the room is, do we have a microphone? We have one, right, okay, sorry. We do have one, so please wait for the microphone so we can record you, and please tell us who you are when you have a comment or ask a question. We'll try to finish certainly before 8 p.m. So Jagan is has an official title, which is Director of the National Institute of Urban Affairs, which is an independent body run by, effectively, the government of India. But in many ways, for Philip and for myself, is the closest thing you get to being a fellow traveler. I mean, in many ways, for the last, I'd say, 8-9 years at least, with a program that we've been running as part of the LSE Cities, the Urban Age Project, where we hold conferences around the world and do research together on the physical and the social and the spatial dimensions of cities, we found that really there's an intellectual alignment in terms of the work that Jagan has been doing in this autonomous body, but also personally, which I'll come to in a moment. I mean, the National Institute of Urban Affairs really is tasked of working with the national government in India across all its major urban initiatives, and that's not a modest task. Particularly in the last years. We'll hear in a moment, and Jagan will talk about not only the Smart Cities Mission, which is Prime Minister Modi's recent investment in urban development across the whole of India, in particular 98 cities, but also touch upon how that fits into a broader context of political engagement with one of the world's most dramatically urbanizing countries, which will sooner or later have certainly the largest city in the world, whether it's Mumbai or Delhi, you'll tell us because you do the statistics. But it's also fascinating how this country is also investing in a series of new initiatives, new forms of governance of cities, and also new forms of design, which we might touch upon in our discussion. So that's his formal role. He's done a lot of teaching, a lot of consultancy and research in many institutions. The second side, I said that there's a sort of fellow traveler dimension, is literally, let's call it nearly a personal one or professional one, in the sense that there are few people who trained as architects who've been interested in real stuff, how you put buildings together, and the theory around buildings and architectural theory in I'd say the best sense of the word. What is the what is contemporaneity in architecture? What does it mean to actually build with in a local and regional context? And even though he studied in the States and in India over the years in extraordinary institutions, he, like me, you started but didn't finish a PhD. I didn't even try. So that's interesting. But through that experience, Jagan was very closely connected to someone called Kenneth Frampton, who will be familiar to some of you in the room, not all of you. Ken Frampton is an architectural historian and theoretician who, in fact, last week won the Golden Lion at the Venice Biennale for his lifetime achievement in work, and very interested at this relationship, in fact, canonical text he wrote about architecture and production, and basically the relationship between society and the making of architecture. So I think why Dragan is particularly interesting to us, to the Executive Master's students today, and every one of you who've come from other organizations, institutions in London, is because of this interconnectivity between the policy world, the real nature of having to work with politicians who get elected and count on you in getting things done well, and also the tensions that that creates personally. I worked for a time as an advisor to one of the mayors of London. You know, not everything is perfect, but on the other hand, you've got a job to do. We have a couple of mayors and deputy mayors in the room. They know exactly what that means. And I think it's those sort of tensions between the reality of change and the ambitions and the visions in a way set by policymakers which interest us. At the heart of it is, as I say, the country of India, which will have more people living in cities probably than anywhere else. And there's a lot of work to do. And Dragan is going to tell us about one of the initiatives, but as I say, in a wider context, using a number of slides and talking to us. So, will you please join me in welcoming Dragan Shah to the LSE?
Thank you, Ricky, for that really wonderful introduction. Now that you mentioned Ken, I think it's really important that I do acknowledge the fact that I'm not an intellectual. I don't consider myself that. I'm very much a sort of administrator, manager of programs and research and so on at my institute. But the intellectual formation that I received with reading Ken's writings and then interacting with him at Columbia University has stood me in good stead, I think, overall, just in terms of being able to be what he once referred to as the reflective practitioner. I'm trained as a practitioner, then studied history, theory, and criticism. I was never trained as a planner, didn't ever imagine I would actually work in the urban sector per se. But somehow, I guess, the formative years of training or learning at Columbia University and with people like Ken really brought me into the realization, realization that to think of architecture and urbanism and the city and development, broadly speaking, in isolation was simply a foolhardy pursuit. Clearly, these are so closely connected that it would be really meaningless. And then to return to India and then dive into professional practice and then engaging with the Indian city, which when I returned from the Columbia University in 1997 was a bit of a mess pretty much. Nobody was paying attention to it. And then being involved in, fortunately getting the opportunity to be involved in forming some kind of an urban narrative, some kind of a response to what seems to be a futile pursuit to actually look at planned urbanization in a country like India. Was something that I could draw a lot on my studies and research, and it's almost impossible for me to pinpoint exactly what that genealogy of ideas is, but it's there. I rely on it. Let me. That's my title slide. So the global narrative, what is it? Everybody, I think, in the room probably knows it. It's the Sustainable Development Goals. Goal 11 is talked about a lot. Build safe, resilient, inclusive, sustainable cities. India as a government has committed to achieving this agenda by 2030. We've also committed in the Paris Agreement to reducing our carbon footprint. And we're also buffeted by the forces of global finance, both in its positive and negative senses, both. India is seen as a market, as being a place where, in a sense, money can be turned around. Most recently, of course, we are a hunting ground for pension funds to find better interest returns on their funds, especially from Canada and many other countries. So it is a very, one might say, highly an environment of both opportunism, hope, as well as possibility. For a long time, the Indian government treated cities as being sort of not very desirable. India lives in its villages is something associated with Mahatma Gandhi as having been somebody who despised cities. I would argue, and I have done some research on his writings, I would argue simply because he was so much under the sway of the influence of John Ruskin, whom he acknowledged in one of his books as being the formative influence on his thinking. So you can imagine John Ruskin writing after this, unto this past, I think, as his last book, almost a tirade against industrialization and urbanization and all the evils of the 19th century Europe, having influenced Mahatma Gandhi, who was a, sort of like a messiah figure for us. In the middle of all of that, somehow our cities got embroiled in that, and we ended up as a government neglecting cities over 50 years. So as a result of which, I'm not sure you can see these slides clearly, but can you? Okay. Not the greatest images, but nevertheless. Just snapshots, slums, paucity of water, sanitation, heritage areas completely overrun by consumerism, infrastructure being retrofitted into what has been largely unplanned urbanization is the kind of landscape that we are talking about. India has also been referred to, and almost in a kind of disparaging way, by the especially Bretton Woods institutions as being a reluctant urbanizer, not really wanting to urbanize, and how silly that is. But clearly, we had a lot to do after independence. We had to literally drag a lot of our population out of poverty. And then I guess it's only really after economic liberalization sets in 1991 that we begin to even conceive of a different kind of economy, and clearly one that had to be centered around urbanization. I don't expect that you will even try and read any of these slides, but really that's just a comparison between countries like India, Indonesia, China, Mexico, Korea, and so on, showing that we are roughly 31% urbanized, whereas Brazil is 87% urbanized. This is all sort of part of a lot of what I consider to be hubris around the whole discourse on urbanization. It's the way in which consultants and so on sell urbanization to governments, and these kinds of graphs, while they represent real figures, tend to distort the real view we have of urbanization, and most importantly, this particular figure of 31%, which I will just try and cast some light on. But equally important as pension funds and returns on investment and all of that is the imagination of an urban India. And that imagination hasn't quite been articulated, certainly not collectively, certainly not across our country, which is divided in, it's a federation of states, and then some 4,000 plus cities, but actually more likely to be 8,000 plus cities. So we don't have a narrative in our country about what is the city, what does it represent, what does it mean to successive generations of people. But clearly, it's been part of the imagination of the country. And whether it is famous painters like F.N. Souza, who paints a wonderful landscape there, or other painters, or even miniature painters of miniatures who visualize Krishna in his city of Dwarka. The city has been part of our imagination. Overall, simply not something that the state has taken enough cognizance of. This is one visual I love from 1946. It's actually extracted from a book by the American planning theorist or scholar Norma Evanson, The Indian Metropolis, from that book, showing an advertisement for cement from 1946. And really the kind of, I love the allegory in this painting, really. I don't know if you can make out these figures, Indian figures wearing suits, hat, looking out onto a new landscape made with cement, and far off in the distance, the village that we've left behind. So this building of this kind of narrative has been sporadic, but highly influential on the imagination of Indians, especially in defining what we consider to be modernity itself. And somehow the city has been pulled into that whole narrative. Now realities condition our imaginations, and that's a narrative which hasn't been built up well enough. I'm sure a lot of you are very familiar with these images, but just to highlight the fact that realities like industrialization led to Ebenezer Howard's vision, or realities about the car and how it moves to the city led Eugène Hénard to think of, actually invent the roundabout. The working class housing required by the industrial city led to Tony Garnier's imagination of what an industrial city would look like. And of course, famously, Corbusier's sort of, one might say, his despising of the center of Paris led to him thinking of a radiant city that would replace that historical landscape. So these realities do condition our responses. Equally well, an Indian architect and urban designer, Satish Grover, who conceives of one of the sort of extensions of Delhi, thinking of an urban landscape that to us is precisely the kind of landscape we don't want today, but there is a sort of exuberance in the use of color and the showing of humans walking around pretty much like carved, showing us little figures in Paris, really saying that, well, you know, this is how I think cities ought to be. Or for that matter, Richard Rogers, thinking of a sustainable future city, which is a kind of a mega structure, really possibly derived from ideas from Archigram, Situationists, and so on, a mixture of uses, all kinds of different architectures, in a sense, put together through this technological megastructure that brings it all together. All of this has contributed to the imagination of smart cities. Unfortunately, in India, since 1991 and economic liberalization, it's this kind of an image which has survived in everybody's mind. This kind of gentrified, car-oriented landscape. This is a township in a city called Pune, currently almost fully constructed. But the pedestrians pushed off to the sides, almost as if they enjoy that, and the cars roaming quite freely on the roads. This is the sort of the conspicuous consumption of space, of capital, and of a different kind of narrative. And this is the prosperity, the modernity that has become synonymous with our dreams. Of the future. There are consequences, obviously, to this kind of imagination. One big consequence, and really this is the first crucial slide in my presentation, is that we've ended up allowing the country to be overrun by what have been described by the World Bank as messy and hidden urbanization. The fact that if you use standards used by many countries around the world for defining what is urban, then this is what looks like urban settlements in India. So far from the 31% that is officially recognized to be urban India, as acknowledged by the economic survey of 2016-17 of the Ministry of Finance of our government, we may well be 80% urban. So data is clearly something that, I don't know what's the appropriate word for it, but it's certainly malleable, certainly is something that one can play with. But the census of 2011 does record some very startling facts. The fact that there has been almost 3,000 cities added in one decade, a lot of those are what are called census towns. Right? So a lot of our urbanization is not controlled or managed by municipalities. Census towns are urban areas that assume all the characteristics of being urban, but without all the municipal services. So these are rural areas, they still fall under the rural ministry, and yet assume all the characteristics of the urban, but not the urbane, you might say. Urban agglomerations have grown dramatically. That figure, 91, is dramatic, because an urban agglomeration is a statutory town, one that has a municipality, but surrounded by an outgrowth or census towns, at least one census town. So what's happening in India is sort of graphically represented by this kind of spawning urbanization. This is a zoom in onto a nightlights kind of image taken by the World Bank in their analysis of urbanization in India. And what it shows is a primate city down there in these dots, what it used to be in 2001 and then what in one decade it becomes, shown by the purple. So this is what's happening. Cities coalescing with other cities, almost a continuum of urbanization. And we have regions like Delhi, which are going to be part of some of the mega urban regions of the world. Now, imagine that, and imagine that first image I showed of shortages of infrastructure, shortages of water supply, all of that, and unplanned urbanization, and this looks like it's possibly a disaster. So how does one intervene? McKinsey Global Institute in 2010 wrote, I would imagine, you know, they should be given a prize because they completely changed or determined the course of discourse within the governments of India on urbanization by this one report, which I won't go into the merits or demerits of it, but nevertheless made one very significant pronouncement that India will need to house its population, will need to build a new Chicago every year. Now, if our imaginations were a little better honed, we would be a little circumspect about that, but we aren't. So we decided we will build a new Chicago every year. Also didn't acknowledge that new Chicago had been built, but it's simply unplanned. So, you know, the ways in which influential, almost sort of branded research can set trajectories in countries like India is something which is worth thinking about for all researchers. But I don't intend to dwell on this too much. But I just want you to stay with that image. They do talk about some key issues which are, of course, quite real in terms of our challenges. And then the very next year, a high-powered expert committee brought out an estimation of what are our financing and funding sort of challenges for urbanization in India. Again, the graph is not so important as simply these figures here. We need something like 0.4 trillion to actually build the roads and water supply and so on. But importantly, and this is the power of footnotes, in the report, in the footnotes, it mentions that another close to, you know, the similar figure is required to maintain, operate and maintain the infrastructure that we will build. And this does not include primary education, health, and so on and so forth. So you can imagine that, you know, country policy on urbanization in India tends to be somewhat sketchy. And then we have the Erstwhile Planning Commission in their report of 2011, planning for the final and really the last five-year plan that we would have, a sort of remnant of the socialist era, saying, well, here are the challenges. And these are not inaccurate, not at all. But again, you know, iterate the point that we need to invest a lot more in our cities. We are spending $17 per capita. We should be spending $100. Again, sort of almost a footnote, but ignored very quickly, that India does need to start a political process where the urban issues are debated with the evolution of meaningful solutions. These are the kinds of statements which, of course, just get sort of left behind, but clearly what matters. And then we have an institution, the Indian Municipality, which has been created out of an act of an amendment to the Constitution of India in 1993. In fact, this year we are celebrating 25 years of that 74th amendment to the Constitution of India, which in a schedule called the 12th schedule lays down the 18 responsibilities of the Indian Municipality. Now, if you do read very quickly what those responsibilities are, of course, they make sense. That's what a municipality anywhere in the world would do. But our municipalities don't have the capacity for it, they don't have the funds for it, they don't have the people for it. So what we refer to as funds, functions, and functionaries, these three Fs simply don't exist, even in cities like the national capital of Delhi or Bombay or Calcutta or you name it. I mean, any city will simply not have the capacity, funds, or even have the devolution of functions that this talks about. As of today, out of all our states, not a single state has devolved all these. So 25 years after a constitutional amendment, we are yet to devolve all these functions because of some skullduggery in the drafting of the legislation, which gave the option to the state governments to actually enact this reform. And there's a good reason why that didn't happen. One of the key reasons, again, illegible text here doesn't really matter, just it is a visual representation. And that's a quote from our Prime Minister, reform to transform. The 74th Amendment required that we reform the way in which cities were managed. And what you see are these green lines is the extent to which some of the fundamental reforms were actually carried out. Most states are able to only reach 50%. These reforms are what you might call very commonsensical things, like cities should maintain ledgers, they should do double entry accounts. So for instance, they should know how much money is coming in and how much money is going out. Today, how much is coming in is simply not accounted for. So they cities actually have sort of registers where they maintain some notes about how much they're spending on various things. It's at that level. So reform was fundamental to this, pushed by all the funding agencies around the world that looked at India. And yet, today, and literally this is a picture of a month ago, when we did a third-party assessment of reforms in different states, this is the picture. There are a few states that have done well, also represented by this kind of a diagram. That's the state of Andhra Pradesh. That's the state of Kerala. So there are about four or five states that, in this diagram, you can tell, have achieved a fairly high level of reform, but look at the rest. They are way behind. So just in terms of context setting, I think you get the picture. How to intervene in this? Where do you start? Do you start with legislation? Do you start with building capacity? It's mind-boggling. I mean, do you start with money? Do you just infuse money into this, throw money at it, throw technology at it? What do you do? So we had to devise a way to intervene. And I'm going out on a limb here because this is not the logic. This is not the official logic of the Smart Cities Mission or anything here. Really, my reading of how the political economy is being shaped. One thing that we need to do, of course, and let me explain what this is. These numbers represent the numbers of smart cities being built in different states. But what's important is this context. These red lines represent what is called the Golden Quadrilateral. It's national highways and a very ambitious national highway program, pretty well executed. These thin black lines represent freight corridors, which go from the coast here up to Punjab, and one that connects to Bombay. And these high-speed freight corridors will, we expect, have a significant impact on our economy. And then we've got these green circles, which represent international airports, and the blue line, which represents a linking with logistics networks of all the ports of India. So perhaps this is a good way to start. Really, where is the national economy and national infrastructure going, and how do we see our cities placed in that context? This is official statement, so this comes out of a little book that's been brought out last week, capturing the achievements of our government over the last 4 years. And what I think is sort of almost like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but essentially looking at a sanitation program that covers all our cities, also a urban livelihoods program, and then investing in trunk infrastructure in 500 cities, and then having smart cities that really target an overall improvement of the quality of life. So almost a calibrated kind of response to all of this. Get your sanitation, get some basics in all the cities, fill all the gaps in infrastructure in about 500. These are all 500 cities of 100,000 and above population. And then treat 100 smart cities as your what I would call innovation labs. These cities where you begin to look at how to change things around. Clearly, national infrastructure is one aspect, but then there's local potential. And here I use images, and do forgive me for using these images
without formal acknowledgement, but these are LSE city research outcomes. Really looking at the fabric of cities, these are only the biggest cities, but really just a visual reminder that every city has its own identity, its own structure, its own morphology, and its own economic activities and so on and so forth. So really, can we leverage local potential in all of our cities? Leverage city sciences, and here again, illustrative examples. These are just diagrams where in our institute we broke down solid waste management. I mean, just to figure out really, if you take a piece of plastic and you throw it into the garbage, where can it end up? Can you earn revenues from it? What can you do? How much lands up in the landfill and so on and so forth, and different kinds of ways. Essentially to reinforce the point that the city is a space of scientific handling and management, and almost every single aspect of it needs to be managed scientifically. And really, can we leverage our ability today to do that, to harness science for managing cities better, especially because the entire world is willing to support us, handhold us, provide us technologies, sciences, research, and so on to do that. And also very importantly, and here I draw on what is an influential sort of argument presented by Ed Glaser and Abba Joshi Ghani in their book of the same name, Rethinking Cities, where essentially they're arguing that, look, if you have to now act on your cities, and this is not a prescription for India alone, this is their view of cities, begin to look at the creative potentials in urban populations. Look at diversity, look at the fact that there are what they refer to as sort of, I think they call them thick sort of labor markets, places where you create the possibility of innovation, collaboration, co-creation, and so on. And certainly move towards a more inclusive city, because divided cities are really counterproductive. And the fact that you need the mix of industries and economic activities, and of course, cash in on the returns on education, which we don't really do. So I come to sort of some of the key reasons why smart cities in India make sense. And so I am defending this. I was one of the authors of the mission, sort of the guidelines and so on. And while I find it extremely difficult to defend it, nevertheless, I think it's important because there is an opportunity. One very important reason why we must do that is the need for speed. We have to become smarter about how we handle our cities because time is not on our side. The pace of urbanization, the scale which I shared with you, doesn't allow us the comfort of sort of easy process. It's got to be done fast. It's got to be done effectively. The cost of failure and the cost of inaction is unaffordable. We simply can't fail at what we're doing in our cities. And very importantly, the big opportunity, and here certainly forms one of the sort of DNAs of the Smart Cities mission in our country, digitalization. The huge opportunity that it gives us for various reasons. One, because it helps us to target our investments better. Secondly, because it helps us to understand the scope of our problems better. I mean, of course, it's a cliche. I don't want to repeat it very much, but people do say, right, if you can't measure, you can't manage. But also, importantly, correlate. It's very important for us to understand, and I say this because our institute handles something called parliament questions, questions asked by parliamentarians about the urban sector get routed to us by the ministry. And it's a little frightening, that parliamentarians are asking basic questions like, would the Minister of Housing and Urban Affairs tell us, is India urbanizing very rapidly? You know? So it's that level at which our political discourse is still sort of mired in a reluctance to engage with the urgency of the urban. So clearly we need to understand that poverty, cities, the economy, industry 4.0, everything is connected, and we need to find the basis by which we can engage with that. And digitalization offers us that opportunity to measure what we're dealing with. Away from digitalization is also a sort of a moral value. And I think this This is important. I always use this slide for no other reason but to reinforce the fact that contrary to what we believe, and you know, part of the cynicism of the state is very much not having faith in its citizens. But contrary to that, a process like what we refer to as town planning schemes, where different farmers come together and they share land, build infrastructure, make space, are willing to have, this might not be very legible, but they, at the end of that process, they only get about 50% of their land back. All of this is done through a kind of self-organization, aided by municipal corporations, of course, with technical support, but really reinforcing the fact that people are willing to work with each other. They can co-create a better city. And this gets lost in the sort of almost futility of what we're dealing with. And it's really important for us to remember that. A big problem is the surging demands. And these demands are, you know, like I mentioned, you know, cities are dealing with demands which they simply have no language to deal with, no capacity to deal with. And yet these word clouds represent you know, so many different issues which get thrown at the city manager on a daily basis. And clearly, we need to find a way to intervene in that. And so, my only slide, which is actually directly linked to the Smart Cities mission. So we have what the Prime Minister has given the byline, Mission Transform Nation. So very bold and ambitious. Importantly, the logo, which he designed, interestingly, is of a butterfly, reinforcing the butterfly effect. The fact that if these 100 smart cities can be successes as what we refer to as lighthouses, which can sort of serve as model intervention strategies for other cities, then that butterfly effect will actually resound, will create ripples that will go across the nation and help other cities transform. And to a large extent, whoever's on the ground like us, we see that transformation actually taking place. The mission, just a brief note about actually what the mission really is, what the money is spent on. All told, we are spending about $20 billion or so. It's being leveraged for an overall spend of more than $30 billion US dollars. What are we spending on? We are spending on essentially doing two things. One is that we are either retrofitting or redeveloping parts of these cities. You can pick up 500 acres of your city and propose how you're going to upgrade that entire 500 acres, provide all services, create better public spaces, create safe environments, and so on for women, children, the elderly, a sort of complete upgradation. And with that, also look at how you can use information and communication technology for delivering government services in an efficient way, and what we call pan-city solutions. So every city is basically required to do this. Demarcate an area, talk about how you're going to achieve what's a set template of features, which includes 24/7 water supply, safety on the streets, parking management, all of that stuff. And they're supposed to do at least one project, the pan-city solution, where you use ICT to deliver services to the whole city so that this doesn't become only an exercise in creating an island of excellence. And each city is also required to present a strategy for how they will scale and replicate the effort in this area. All of this is being done as part of a process that started with a challenge. The first time in our country's history where funding from a government program has been given on a competitive basis. No longer about allocating funds like a subsidy, but about cities coming forward, tapping into their potentials, making a plan, a strategy, committing over 5 years to achieving that transformation in their cities, and being judged on a competitive basis. The text in red is important. Again, somewhat game-changing in our context. Each city is supposed to look at an integrated approach. So you're looking at water supply, skill development, improvement of parking, all of this together. In our context, that matters a lot because we work in silos, not unusual in the rest of the urban world, and how to break through those silos and work in an integrated and convergent manner. Importantly, also, each city is expected to set up a company, what we call a special purpose vehicle, which is registered under a very stringent legislation called the Companies Act of 2013, which doesn't really allow for the somewhat irresponsible practices that municipalities in our country are known for. So transparency is important, accounting for your expenditure is important, maintaining process is important for companies, and violations do lead to sort of almost immediate incarceration. So really, this is the intervention strategy of the Smart Cities mission. What has resulted from all of that? And again, just six images out of 99, which have been selected till now, are unprecedented responses, aided by consultants. Each of these cities has come up with the identification of areas. Most of them have gone in for retrofitting existing areas, which is heartening. One might have thought that they would do the kind of conspicuous consumption kind of solution, and make greenfield townships. But actually, they've through a consultative process, they've identified central business districts. They've identified areas where their economy flourishes, and come up with strategies for upgrading all these areas. So, really, this gives hope, and innovations of various kinds have been built into these plans. What have we achieved now in the last 3 years? On the 25th of June, we will complete 3 years of the launch of the mission. Is also unprecedented. We have never got to a point of executing urban projects with this kind of speed and to the level of integration that we are achieving now. Again, you won't be able to read all of this, but it's important to highlight the fact that, for instance, this little yellow part of this is about 50% of funding is going into the infrastructure for these areas of retrofitting and so on. The others are going into that. For instance, this one is going into the ICT solution, and then there are other associated costs. In terms of sources of funds also, it's an interesting story that's emerging. 23% is debt financing. We have a large component of public-private partnership that's coming up, mostly through land value capture, which is a new framework in our country, and it's astounding that in 3 years we've managed to actually work out real land value capture frameworks, and municipal bonds as well. So these are plans which, the financial plans which will get played out over the remaining 2 years of the mission. Importantly, the sectors in which all of our projects are distributed, significantly 19% of the projects across all these cities are urban transport projects. I think that in a sense shows the groundswell of demand for better urban transportation. Economic development projects related to better business process management, how the city can ease business and so on, also form a large chunk of these projects. And we will, again, on the 25th of June, probably, if all goes well, along with support from the Economist research unit, we will bring out our first ranking of all the cities on what we call the City Livability Index. So we do recognize that you have to measure, you have to keep monitoring all of this. We have devised the index with 79 indicators. It's not your ISO, nor is it the SDG, but it speaks to both, but really customized to the mission itself. And you get a sense of what are the kinds of categories under which we will be monitoring progress. So what does transformation look like? I think it basically looks quite mundane, and I use some images quickly to run you through that. Just the visualization courtesy of SEPT University in Ahmedabad, where they have a street like this currently, and what they plan to do is introduce a metro line through that, which will trigger off certain real estate development along that street, and then they will invest in the upgradation of the street infrastructure so that there's more pedestrian space and better traffic management and so on. And over time, the street will become greener. There will be more shaded walking space and cycle tracks and proper management of movement on the roads. It will become more populated, of course, as you can see from the density of human figures. And certainly property speculation along this metro line is going to lead to a lot more floor space being added to the city. My last section of the presentation is about risks and challenges. And I think this this is really important for us to understand, because as we go forward, if we have to replicate any of what we consider to be successes in this mission, we must keep this in mind. And I must start with one of my all-time favorite quotations from Richard Sennett, which really is saying that, well, you know, we don't have a clear idea in our minds about what it is we really want. What is that city which is just, which is, you know, inclusive? What is that resilient, you know, if we use the language of SDGs? And we need to find the language by which we represent what that is, capture what it is. And I think this remains something that is always a reminder that there is a purpose to the Smart Cities mission, to the creation of lighthouse projects, to the creation of models, that at least we will finally have a real manifestation of what we think to be the kind of cities that we want. And I think those images, creating those images, in Sennett's words, confront our masters with those images, is really one of the sort of, one might say, interpretive aspects of this mission, which I interpret to be one of the hidden goals or the rewards of the mission. Some of the challenges. Can we leverage cultural advantage? I mean, let me show you the next slide as well so you'll understand why the dots. Leverage cultural advantage or settle for endless sameness? I can't even remember. I think this is from a UN Habitat document, but really I can't tell which city is what. I hope some of you might. I think one is Lagos, one is São Paulo, one is Madrid. You can't tell anymore what cities are what's different about cities. So really, can we create Indian cities? Is there some possibility there? Why cultural advantage? Because, you know, in the 1820s, when two archaeologists, Gad and Smith, really did a comparison of the Sumerian script with the Harappan script, they found, and I love the fact, that land was represented by these grids in both scripts, that a homestead was represented in that manner. So we had languages 2,300 years ago in the Indian subcontinent for representing order, for representing ownership, for engaging with that reality. And we have, of course, even remnants in the city of Mohenjo-Daro and others of a planned settlement. So these were urban civilizations. Now, I think UNESCO uses the language of innate skills or tacit knowledge. But one might say that in that huge diaspora of engineers that come out of India and go all over the world, they do carry that knowledge. They carry that technical capacity to create order, to create something in a structured way, which not only was there 2,300 years ago. In the early 20th century in Delhi, you had perfectly ordered urban landscape in the heart of Delhi, or the city of Jaipur, which created a rational plan, a gridded rational plan. And we had this second century palm leaf manuscript shows formulae used by an architect, the master builder, who stands there with a scarf and a set square. So this is an urban civilization that somehow lost its way and forgot a lot of this knowledge. Now, I don't want to really sound ridiculous about this, but clearly Indians build, a lot of them build themselves. It's only that the city as a space where they can build together, where the government can play that role of bringing them together to build, to co-create the contemporary city, that function, that that process simply has never really been concretized. And perhaps, and I again, I'm extremely hopeful when I say this, perhaps the Smart Cities mission gives us some of that mechanism, some of that intervention strategy by which we can begin to do that. Very importantly, one of the worst legacies of the modernist movement and modern town planning has been the master plan. And our cities are very much, you know, under the control sway of master planning. So, you know, as I said, this is one of the challenges we still need to deal with. This is just, again, images showing Delhi in 1956, the first master plan, the plan 20 years later, the plan 20 years thereafter, simply not really getting a grip on development at all, simply because it's land and land transactions that have begun to shape the political, not begun to, rather, they determine the political economy in our country. And that will simply have to be changed. If we are not able to use land more efficiently, if we are not able to use it in a more inclusive way, then clearly the Smart Cities mission or any such mission is not going to succeed. So this remains a big challenge for us. Choosing the right models really matters as well. So we're really trying to push for a model like Barcelona and not Atlanta, or a master plan like the London Master Plan, which has just one key diagram. It doesn't really tell you how to use your land use, but really just projects how the city is growing. That's fantastic. And it makes that available in, I think, 14 languages, out of which 4 are Indian languages. That's the way that we should be moving. But it's a challenge to make that process in such a way that we can engage the city and the people of the city and the economic life of the city better. And I think this remains one of our biggest challenges. The inclusive city is not happening tomorrow. Again, somewhat sort of, I guess, metaphorically placing two images together. This is the colonial layout of New Delhi, parts of which you see in this photograph as well. And then this sanitary corridor created with between the old city, the historical city, look at the density there, and the modern city, and really that sanitary corridor, that has gotten embedded in our imaginations. We can't think of inclusive cities yet, because our cities are extremely divided, and it is, this is the only kind of problem which I think can only be solved through politics, through a new kind of politics. We haven't found it yet. This is not a technical solution, a technical problem. This is not a financial problem. This is a problem about literally the psyche of a society, and I use it towards the end of my presentation because of that. So we have to jettison these tropes of divided, ghettoized cities, and it's going to be quite a challenge. Sorry. And my last slide, can we invest in people? Should we find the ways to converge around integrated planning? Can we promote transparency? Can we look at inclusion and diversity in a deeper way by allowing the informal sector to work? It contributes more than 60% of our GDP and yet never figures in official figures of our economy. So if we have the GDP that we have, it's still only capturing partial picture. Can we devolve the task of planning and managing the city to communities? Very importantly, can we decouple? Because we have got locked into a particular kind of development, and clearly, when is that decoupling going to happen? Possibly the smart cities, with their adoption of energy efficiency, with their adoption of renewable sources of energy, or e-vehicles, or cycle tracks, whatever, all of that might result in some kind of a decoupling. Can we work on the trust that I mentioned earlier? Very importantly, the capacity constraints I mentioned. I found this concept on an engagement in Berlin where they say, well, you know, we have the triple helix, something fantastic. But the government working with industry and business and with institutions, it's a travesty of development that you could have a capital city like Delhi, which is an education hub, not only for India, but also for at least South Asia and Southeast Asia, where world-class institutions are not even called to a meeting with government to present solutions, to present viewpoints, and so on. Clearly, that has to change because there's no way we can engender, no process by which we can grow the number of consultants, advisors, and people on the ground that we need to fix our cities. And so we have to find new mechanisms. And I must say, of course, we are working on all of this, but it's a huge agenda. Importantly, Make in India. It's a slogan right now, but the Prime Minister in his first speech after becoming Prime Minister said something like, we need to look at zero effect and zero defect. Well said, actually. I mean, the zero effect is a bit too cryptic, but what he meant was not zero effect in a positive sense, but no negative externalities of the process of manufacturing in India, but importantly, zero defect, because we make things terribly in India. Products, buildings. So you can imagine all that tacit knowledge, all that skill. We have the best crafts in the world, and yet all of it has atrophy. And very importantly, can we invest in the next generation? Can we look at entrepreneurship and innovation as being a national agenda? So these questions remain. They are challenges which I think the Smart Cities mission only begins to frame and engage with. But I think, I'm not a soothsayer, but I think these will continue to be the key themes of the future of urbanization in India. So thank you very much.
Jagandas, that was both informative and I think insightful. Let me just perhaps start with a couple of points, given that you mentioned Richard Sennett. Richard Sennett is a colleague of ours at the London School of Economics, and he's recently written a new book called Building and Dwelling. In fact, he uses the example of Nehru Place as a in a way, his idea of nearly the perfect place.
Okay.
Well, in Delhi, and you'll tell us a little bit more about it, it's a place where many illegal transactions take place, where mobile phones get stolen, remade, including his. Everything is multi-layered and complex, and there's nothing like zoning efficiency or anything else. In many ways, the model that not just this initiative, the Smart Cities one in India, but also in many other countries, has a completely different idea of what the right, correct city is. Right? First of all, it's perfect. It's complete as opposed to incomplete or in progress all the time, changing itself. It's sort of fixed, and it has an idea of where things should happen. Well, in reality, many cities that not only we like, but which function, including London, I would say, for obviously at a completely different scale and economic level, one could say, is messy and organic. And the London plan that you showed is interesting because in many ways it doesn't try and impose an order. It has a degree of elbow room about it. So I was interested to know, given that you can't comment at all on your government's track record and all that, but you're far away here and the press doesn't comment. And I'm not asking you to make a commentary on whether the SMC, the Smart Cities mission challenge, has been successful. Where does this model come from, and is that changing? And does it need to change in order to actually bring about change? And in other words, actually be realistic about that process. Because otherwise, so many of the things you talk about are not just in India, but very difficult to achieve with the speed and the sort of urgency that you talk about from the democratic point of view and from the sustainable point of view. So I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on that, then we can open up.
Great question. I mean, I wasn't aware that Richard talks about Nehru Place. interestingly, Nehru Place is going to have a complete makeover, as they call it. But that might well mean that they'll get rid of all of this messiness and the gray economy of.
You can bet on it.
Yeah, you can bet on that. Because interestingly, it's one of the few large sort of paved open spaces in that part of the city. Yeah. So you can predict that it's the middle class that wants the space. So they want gentrification of the whole space. But to try and answer your question, presently the political economy in the country doesn't like this kind of unregulated business for no other reason than I think, and here I can only draw on some sort of anecdotal evidence from sort of being deeply embedded in this ecosystem, that it's mainly because it's almost impossible for it to be, in a sense, exploited. There's no way you can really seek rent from it. I mean, the police do it on a daily basis, maybe, but that's a well-established system and it's quite predictable and so on. But the governments, the municipalities, don't know how to deal with this. So the only way they see it is erasure. I mean, how do you get rid of it? Because there seems to be no other gain whatsoever. But I think to present the possibilities in this. One is, of course, there's a whole new generation of urban planners, architects, urban designers, who are trying to make a bit of a noise about what kind of city streets and open spaces we want in our cities. They're not very influential. They're largely ignored by governments. Government sees them only as service providers whom you hire. What is happening, I think especially, and I have a lot of faith in sort of the younger generation of these professionals and the larger sort of youth population, we have a youth bulge, we like to talk about that, in civil society, that they're beginning to influence the opinions of their elders and having some sort of nudge effect towards recognizing that our cities are livable because of this informal activities. It's almost that we've got a tussle now between civil society, which sees a lot of good in having night markets and daily sort of chaos, actually, like the chaos, and then governments who see no other way but to regulate to a point of erasure of these good things. I don't know if that really answers your question, but I think I would say that the internet has been a great liberator. Their opinions are being formed. Also being sort of subdued, but also being formed and articulated through the information and communication technology modes that we have, social networks, all of that, at an amazing pace. My children show me opinions being expressed on WhatsApp, which are adult opinions, and they're somehow finding their way into children's WhatsApp communication. It's just fascinating how minds are somehow changing. To what extent the political process will be able to capture this change, which I think has happened, there is a groundswell, is to be seen, and we'll probably see it in a few months.
So just one follow-up. If you even articulated today, and certainly the experience I think Philip and I and others have had in engagement with many of the urban leaders across India at different levels, the belief in technology, in digitalization, as a way of, in a way, resolving the problems of the city, the famous leapfrogging notion, is really quite profound, isn't it? And
disturbing.
Thank
sometimes.
You. Yes, say more. That's what I was getting at.
Right.
That's that. In reality, there are a series of other problems, whether it's sewers or running water, which are not going to, well, might be partially solved by technology, but not necessarily. You need hard infrastructure to do that, and money and desire to do that. So I was just wondering whether you might reflect on that, because I should have said that we were involved at our group in the evaluation of some of the smart city submissions together with you, so we got a good sense of what was being proposed, and there was a sort of feeling that quite a lot of them are out of sync with the real issues on the ground? I guess that those are questions which sort of interest all of us.
No, I think that's a fair assessment of the situation. There is a kind of fetish about technology, which is for administrators who don't really, who are not trained to think independently, and work in an ecosystem where conformism is the only virtue. I think for those administrators, clearly, you know, the pronouncement that technology is the silver bullet is something that they, you know, unquestioningly follow. At the same time, one has also heard administrators voice opinions which question that. So to go back to the narrow place example, really, how much is the questioning, reflective Indian going to actually find a voice in the political discourse is, I think, going to be a national question. Information and communication technology is only part of many themes where we are being, in a sense, told what the future is about. Partly, it's also because of a very weak process of modernization, or modernity, you know, formation of modernity in our country, which has not been led by sort of rational, self-evaluating, reflexive individuals, but still very much relying on leadership to dictate, and not very reflective when they vote. So all that will, I think it will change. What worries me is the speed with which it will change.
Remember, you're talking to us in a country that voted for Brexit. So.
Right. I come from Mumbai or Bombay. My parents were in Gujarat. I assume Mr. Shah is Gujarati. And they came because the party is so green in Gujarat. They came to Mumbai or Bombay. And there was some sort of, we were petty bourgeoisie. I'm 85 years old and remember very well. The way back in when I was a teenager when the independence came. But generally, I think there has been a failure in the polity. Completely, you see, the Mumbai was ruined in such a way. The corruption started way back when the British were there for corruption. But when the independence came, you see, the whole Bombay was greener any grounds were all built up, you see. And the municipality was completely corrupt. India has got a very tiny mass of middle class educated as such. But by and large, if I describe you, where we were 10 in the members' family living in a chawl, and being my, I cry when I think about my mother fetching the water from the bottom. It's so, and it has nothing changed. I've been visiting Bombay time and again, and the atrocious. I've been to Gujarat, state of Modi, and he has been really done only job of giving a sort of leeway to the capitalists. You see, the party is still there. The killing of the Muslim in Gujarat. It's nothing has changed, and all these plans, as my friend is saying, I suspect that will not be fructified.
Can you give us your name?
I'm Alam Yusei Rubani.
Thank you very much. Let's take a couple of comments and then we can, okay, right here, since you're in the front, sir. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Robert Mokka from Helsinki, Demos Helsinki think tank. I was wondering, you didn't touch much the kind of very ambitious technological plans that the central government has with kind of biometric identifications and driving everyone from the informal economy or including them in some way. Okay.
Further away.
Okay. Now it's better. So how do you feel about that? I mean, how do they relate to the smart cities agenda, or do they relate at all?
Okay, two pretty different questions, so take them now.
First, Mr. Rupani, I can understand you're 2 years younger to my father, and he doesn't see much hope either. I think what else is there if not to hope that we can fix this? Maybe here I'm just behaving like an architect, and you know, we're trained to only think about finding solutions.
I think that's what drives these kinds of missions. I believe that that's, you know, what cuts across from the top to bottom, the hope that we can actually change this. Bombay looks like it's unchangeable, but at the same time, it's interesting that, for instance, the World Bank today has a team that's looking at the slums of Bombay as being the creative economies. You know, now even the World Bank had to change its stance. It will have an effect on the way the Indian state thinks about slums as well. So we are rooting for the World Bank on that. You know, if they can influence that thinking, that's fantastic. So, you know, I don't have a satisfactory answer that you will find satisfactory, I'm sure. I wish I could just completely change
it.
The Chinese model is simply not tenable in our context. I don't think Indians really want it. And they also suffer because they get all the really bad Chinese products, which are dumped in India.
And on Roper's questions on the market.
The Aadhaar would be one of the aspects of this, the unique identity card, and also the demonetization, the push for using mobile apps rather than cash, and so on. There's been a huge resistance. So again, signs of hope. I think it was personally, I found that there are some very useful aspects to that. If we can protect identity, if we can protect the privacy of not protect identity so much as privacy. There's a lot of press nowadays where the administrators of this program are on a daily basis messaging to the public that, hey, this is not a problem. Of course, we all believe that there is a problem, clearly, you know. But I think there's parts of that can help us greatly, you know, like I said in my presentation, simply being able to collect data, but, you know, sanitize data, not data with people's identities embedded in it. If we can use that, it will help greatly in managing and planning for our cities. So again, it's a double-edged sword, but a lot of debate on that.
The third row, and then I think there was a...
Thank you, Ricky. Samer Baghi in University of Kent. I'm very interested in your three Fs, and I tell you why. And for me, it was great that you ended on the capacity issue. Now, that's crucial. In my previous job, I was with 100 resilient cities, I'm sure organization you know well, and I worked on 4 of the 40 strategies that have been released. And capacity is a huge issue, and it's actually a huge barrier in getting some of the work done. So I'm assuming there was a cash injection in terms of funds, so that's the first F. So what did you do with the other two Fs? Particularly, I think, as Ricky said, it's an accelerated timeline. I'm assuming there was no time to build capacity at the same time as doing the work. So it would be great if you can kind of go into that a bit. Thank you.
Sure. One of the sort of tactical aspects of the mission, shall I answer? Or?
Yeah, you go ahead. Yeah.
One of the tactical aspects was not to get mired into engaging with the broader sort of structural distortions, such as master planning, for instance. If we had tried to change the master plan of 100 cities, we'd all sort of be dead and gone before that happened. So really at a tactical level, getting cities to view the transformation of space and physical infrastructure as being simply a project that they needed to execute, you might say even just purely part of the maintenance or upgradation of the city, rather than try and change all the other structures which constrain that kind of action. So that was one way in which we dealt with that. Capacity overall, I think, continues to be an interesting sort of narrative that's emerging here, where while governments at the state level are not devolving functions and not providing capacity to the cities. What the last 3-4 years, what we've seen is that people have woken up to the fact that cities need to, in a sense, determine their own destiny.
because clearly funds are not enough. Even if there was money, it would simply not be enough for funding all the changes you need to do and all the people you need. So cities are beginning to now think for themselves about how they can tap in. And interestingly, the private sector is beginning to play a more significant role, augmenting capacity almost through a kind of a social responsibility kind of way. So we're trying to make sure that wherever something like this as a positive movement is happening, we disseminate as soon as possible so that other cities see the possibility. But it's an ongoing project.
Maybe I can make just a little plug for our executive masters. But I mean, it is interesting how through the help, in fact, of Bloomberg Philanthropies, we have been able to have a number of people from Indian civil service, in fact, at state level, involved in our relatively focused, concentrated one-year program. Let's take two questions here in a row.
Hi, Jagan. That was really great. Thank you for sharing the information there. I have a question about capacity as well.
Yeah.
Sorry, is that too close?
Tell us who you are.
My name is Ankita, and I live in London. I'm an architect. My question is related to timeline, and you mentioned quality and how time and quality are linked, and especially in the development of smart cities, that will be something that we may have to keep an eye on. Are there feedback loops or mechanisms in place to capture that, which is, in a way, I think in the future will help create more realistic timelines to achieve quality? And the second question is really related to capturing experience as well in the spaces, because then that feeds back into realistic planning for cities. So have there been any discussions in that? Do you have any more information in that, how that might be managed or planned?
Can you pass the microphone straight up, gentleman in front of you? Yeah, there.
Thank you. Loris Meister. Thank you for your talk. I really like it. It was really great. I wanted to connect the beginning when you said you talk about inspiration and the end about the that picture with the urban traditional urban fabric and the modernist part. And from my point of view, the Indian architecture is really beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful you have. And the traditional urban fabric is really great, but it seems there's a problem of perception from the Indians. How do they perceive their heritage?
If you take those two, and then we have a couple of questions here, one on the front.
Thanks, Ankita, for asking about timelines. I should have given more information on that. There's been a lot of bad press about the Smart Cities mission, that it hasn't spent enough funds after 3 years and so on. About 60% of the projects are at the stage of preparation of DPRs, the detailed project reports. So the expectation is that in this calendar year, we should be able to ground all of those in sort of at a stage of execution. Timelines overall in the mission are not only restricted to the 5 years of the mission per se, which is from 2015 to 2020, but a lot of the projects are going to go to 22. That's how they've been projected. As far as feedback is concerned, there is a feedback loop. In fact, interestingly enough, the Prime Minister is the biggest feedback loop. He's grilling the city managers and the bureaucrats at the center as well, and that's a fascinating process, because there is almost a resistance amongst a lot of bureaucrats to the smart cities mission. They find it's too much of a disruption. It's simply expecting them to do stuff which they don't consider to be in any way valuable, especially because of disruptions in everything. Just new ways to do things. He actually, there's this review program that called Pragati Progress, in which he video conferences with the ministry and officers, and literally asks them to say where they are with projects. I'm not celebrating this fact, but I'm just saying that that's one important feedback loop. Citizens and the press are asking a lot of questions, which is good. Not enough. I would imagine there'd be a lot more. I think because in general we are a little skeptical about any government program, really. I mean, so the media doesn't really talk about government programs, basically. There's a lot of other stuff, you know, day-to-day politics and crap, but, you know, not enough about the actual projects being executed by the government. And I think that's a structural flaw in civic discourse in our country. Don't know what to do to fix that. But I think possibly that, you know, all that hubbub that happens on the social networks with the youth somehow actually gets onto television. Perhaps if they turn up in studios, that might help a lot. Because people are talking, but it's not what you'd expect. There is, but it's too small and, you know, doesn't agglomerate. Yeah, so there isn't, it doesn't form a movement. The question about the heritage, yeah. It's heartening, and you know, I mentioned that a lot of the cities selected the areas which were in the center of their city, the old business districts, and a lot of them are also heritage zones, you know, so in South India, temple towns, you know, choosing the area around their temples. These are not places where modern industry or modern business is conducted. These are traditional spaces and narrow streets and congestion and, you know, all of that. And a lot of, I can't remember exactly, I think about 37 out of all the cities have actually selected historical areas to upgrade in the Smart Cities Mission. So, you know, it's heartening that at least there isn't that rejection of these spaces as being in any way, a problem for the
and
city.
That's also because of the process.
Yeah, it's also because of the consultation process by which citizens were actually asked to vote. There were polls. They were asked to actually sort of vote for areas that they wanted the city to take up. So
my question was more like, are the Indians proud of that? Do they see that as really a good thing they want to give up in a new way?
Yes, in these 37.
I don't think there's much talk about it per se, simply because heritage has become too closely, I think it's just got sucked into tourism. You know what I'm saying? It's just so actually the awareness about local heritage is fueled a lot by domestic tourism, which is actually the bigger trend than international tourism coming into India. So people are discovering stuff they didn't know existed about Indian cities. Take, for instance, of course, this is an easy sort of example, but Banaras, Varanasi, right? One of the oldest cities in the world. Most Indians really had no consciousness about the place. And even if you leave aside the fact that it was something the Prime Minister treated as his constituency and fought elections from there. But even if you leave that aside, today everybody knows that there is such a city. And it was a city where you went to basically, offer the ashes of people who had died to the river. But now it's part of people's consciousness that Banaras is there. It's an ancient city. It has an old university. It's really an important center of learning. So, again, you know, I don't really know how to speed everything up. If we were a knowledge economy, it would get speeded up a lot better. If there was more publishing, more media, more responsible press talking about all this, as you are fortunate to have in this country, then we would...
We're coming up to time, so maybe one last question, but then you can all come down and have a chat with Jagan.
Hi, I'm Mrinmay. I'm from India. Thanks, Jagan. It's always a pleasure to listen to you. Congratulations for completing 3 years of Smart City and 1 year of Livable Index. That's really good. My question is not related to this. Where I'm saying, in India, we had been long time stuck up in urban planning process of making master plan. So can, and it miserably fails every time. We have one colorful map, and then for next 20 years, we fight to retain that map, because there is a lot of political as well as social pressure who want to take it away, who really don't want to follow that master plan. But still, as a planner, as urban managers, we have to fight to retain that plan. So can you see in the near future, or can you see there is a better option to just scrap this practice and talk more about liberal practices for developing its more realistic approaches, split the city into smaller pieces, or talk about just zoning, not any rigid master planning, because preparing a master plan is a hectic exercise that we do, and retaining is even more. So each time we change the color, every 5 years we have assessment, every 5 years we do change it. Can you see, as a planner, we are going towards a way where we are going to abolish this practice and start something new?
Abolish colors. might help.
So some heartening news on that, and also some troubling aspects. There is a national urban policy being formulated, which actually promotes strategic planning, sort of what we saw in the case of London master plan, as opposed to master planning. But while the same ministry is bringing out a national urban policy, it also has a program by which it provides millions of dollars worth of funding to 500 cities to prepare master plans. So, you know, that's the right hand and the left hand not knowing what they're doing. That problem remains. But in terms of thinking, at least at the central government level, it has clearly changed to free up land use control altogether, to adopt mixed land use or really area-based planning and land value capture, essentially. Also because it's a bit of a crisis financially, there's no way we have enough money in our GDP, however much we boast of it, to actually fix our cities. So the cities have to auto-generate, in a sense, the finance required. And land value is the only reliable way to do that.
I'm afraid that because some people have commitments at 8 o'clock, it's good to stop now. But please, some of you have questions, just come and ask Dragan and have a conversation with. Let me just conclude by saying that you started by saying, I'm just a manager. Just remember that. It's interesting what you said. And so many of us are involved in city thinkings, delivering ideas, teaching, research, etc. It's very, very clear that unless those who are tasked to deliver change in cities are able to think and to think critically, as you have shown us, we're not going to get very far. So I think we've been privileged tonight, Dragan, to have your insights. You behaved impeccably as a civil servant. We will not tell anyone that there was an undercurrent of critique, but that was our interpretation. But we very much thank you for having joined us and for joining us for the whole week. Thanks very much.
Thank you.